You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi everyone, I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and illuminate the damage military service does to Americans and foreign citizens around the world. How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys the lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false? Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You can listen to us at 9 a.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month right here on KBOO. And thanks.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
D Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. We are a day after the changing of the guard, so to speak. We saw the relatively peaceful, if you could call it that, transfer of power. Donald Trump is no longer the president, and now the control of the White House is now in the hands of Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris from the city of Oakland. The Senate is now controlled by the Democrats, and the Congress is now controlled by the Democrats. For some people, that is a welcome change, considering what they were facing under Donald Trump. For others, it's a welcome change, but one with caution, meaning that, yes, there's been a changing of a guard, but if you are looking to transform many of the things in this country in any sort of radical way, you're not going to necessarily find an easy path with the current administration under Biden and Harris. We wanted to talk to Max Blumenthal. He's a friend of the show. He's no stranger to our airwaves. He's the editor-in-chief of The Gray Zone. He's an award-winning journalist, the author of several books, including Republican Gomorrah, Goliath, The 51-Day War, and The Management of Savagery. And I wanted to talk to him to, first of all, get his take on this new change, and also about the insidious laws that are being passed all over the country in the wake of the January 6th attempted coup. These laws are being passed, but they seem to be aimed at people who are protesting police brutality and other injustices. So, Max, welcome to the show. And how you doing this afternoon?
I'm good, Davey. Good to be back.
So let me start with the obvious one. Your thoughts on, you know, getting rid of Trump and having a new administration in.
Well, I can tell you that this was the strangest inauguration I've ever witnessed in D.C. I went out yesterday just to kind of gauge the scene. And what I saw in the streets were more journalists than people, and people restricted from their own monuments, their own capital, and their own national mall, and even their own downtown, because of this heavy-handed response to the Capitol riot, in which the Capitol police themselves barely showed up. And so what you have is a giant military show of force with something like 28,000 National Guard. That's more than the number of U.S. troops in South Korea, three times more than the number of U.S. troops in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined. And they're basically just standing around the city, kind of loitering because they don't have anything to do.
Right.
There was all this hype about these right-wing attacks that were going to take place based on very little information. And so the city is on lockdown. There was no peaceful transition of power. And I was unable to observe or experience anything about the inauguration unless I watched this really grim inaugural concert that was put on, that CNN aired, in which was preceded by the anchors fawning over Biden and Harris and really, you know, tearing up over the end of the Trump era. And I think, you know, we were witnessing sort of a change in tone, but it's unclear to me how, you know, the system that produced Trump is going to change under this administration. And we're definitely witnessing a securitization or a militarization of the nation's capital that's unprecedented, in which our mayor, Muriel Bowser, who is a protege of New York's neoliberal billionaire mayor, Mike Bloomberg, has called the new normal. So many of these security measures are going to stay for a while.
Boy, Max, you said a whole lot. We could do a show on just one part of what you said. Let me go back to this. I didn't realize you were in D.C., so that caught me. Because last time I talked to you was in L.A., that we had you on the show, but you must have been visiting. But let's go back to this. In D.C., during the Capitol insurrection, which is the words they're using, a lot of times when we see protests, you know, when they show them on TV, it makes it seem like, whoa, the whole world is under siege. But during that January 6th, how widespread was this unrest? Was it something that, you know, I mean, obviously it was troubling, it was disturbing, it was something that needed to be addressed. But the way it was described, you felt like at any minute, you know, this could be jumping off 3,000 miles away in Oakland, and it could, you know, there was enough people that they could have overwhelmed New York. Or was it really, in the larger scheme of things, a small group of people who attacked the building that in reality could have been repelled, especially if they had the type of presence that they had yesterday?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I am in D.C. I'm like 15 minutes away from the Capitol. So I went up there on January 6th. And, you know, I was on the ground, as journalists say. I was basically, I ran up to the back of the Capitol right after Capitol Police had shot one of them, the military veteran and pro-Trump activist Ashley Babbitt, and saw all of these, this motley crew of characters, each one a different kind of archetype of right-wing militia or pro-Trump MAGA character, just pouring out of the Capitol, getting pepper sprayed, some with the woman's blood on their hands and screaming about a woman being shot. And I thought that, you know, this mob was going to get incensed and they were gonna get revenge and kill people. But pretty much they spent the rest of the day concentrated around the Capitol. There were, I would say, you know, at least 20,000 of them stretching out along the National Mall. And they were screaming, drinking, partying, just milling around, trying to break back into the Capitol. And, you know, by the end of the day, by like 5 o'clock, the police began tear gassing them in a very sustained fashion. Clouds of tear gas engulfed the crowd, and the crowd began pushing back, or being able to be pushed back. They left in almost like a single file line, or in somewhat orderly fashion. By 6:30, which was a half hour after the mayor had declared curfew, and by 7 o'clock, Congress was back in session. And most of the members of Congress had either been evacuated or they went to the Longworth building through tunnels. A lot of people don't know there are these tunnels from the Capitol building to the offices. Cori Bush, the freshman from St. Louis, who was active in the Ferguson protests, actually gave an interview while she was in her office during the riot. And she, to a local St. Louis affiliate, said, you know, I'm not afraid of what's going on. I was a protester. I mean, this is like, and really what it felt like was a high intensity protest with the tear gas, the flashbangs. But I realized after I analyzed the footage of what took place in the Capitol that the shooting of Ashley Babbitt by a Capitol police officer, after this crowd was able to easily push through outnumbered Capitol police, that shooting stopped them in their tracks and they just turned tail and ran after that one single shooting. So I don't want to underplay what took place there and not and say that this was, you know, something normal. It was just a protest. I mean, this was definitely unprecedented, and the intentions of the crowd, this mob, was to interfere with and stop the certification of the election, to basically interfere with the government. But they didn't really have a plan. The people who had planned the rally, the Stop the Steal rally, are the same people who showed up at the Four Seasons landscaping company in a parking lot because they thought it was the Four Seasons hotel. I mean, so it was basically a bunch of Ku Klux clowns who have not really materialized at state capitals or in DC this time. And so I think it's important to keep this in perspective and have a proportionate response that doesn't authorize or create kind of political momentum for a new Patriot Act, which is what a lot of elements in our national security state want to do.
Right, which leads me to my next question, and I'm glad, Max Blumenthal, you gave that context. Because now what we are looking at is, you know, the ramping up of a bunch of mini Patriot Acts, if you may, because these are laws that are being proposed and being implemented and being enhanced on the state side of things.
Yeah.
And I want to see if you could talk a little bit about this. From my understanding, you know, many of these laws, these anti-protest laws, were being bantered about, starting with Standing Rock. They were enhanced during the George Floyd protest. And now, ironically, in many of the states that, you know, would give fervor, you know, where you found a lot of the vitriol against a lot of the vitriol around the results of this election, these are the states, these Republican primarily controlled states, that are the ones it's like, okay, now let's use the insurrection as an excuse to now cement these anti-protest laws. So let's talk a little bit about them and what do we know about them?
Right. Well, many of these laws were proposed in the wake of the George Floyd protests, but they represent a long history of reactionary and right-wing attempts to suppress protest, as well as social movements, and particularly revolutionary social movements. But these were issued at the state level in response to the resurgence of Black Lives Matter last summer. So one bill, which was pushed by the right-wing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think it was introduced last September, is called the Combating Violence Disorder and Looting and Law Enforcement Protection Act. And this law basically issues a third degree felony for anyone participating in what would be defined as a riot. So if you go out to protest and the protest turns into throwing water bottles at cops who are tear gassing you or beating you with batons, well, you just participated in a riot and you can be charged with a felony, not even a misdemeanor. Three or more people engaging in a public disturbance, which is pretty easily defined, just basically a protest, that could be a second degree felony. And you can be charged for being in an aggravated riot, which is the same thing, but nine or more people. And then there's a part of the bill that refers to the wave of statue toppling when Confederate flags and monuments were taken down by protesters. That becomes a third degree felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. So they really want to protect their Confederate monuments. And in another, even more red state, Mississippi, there's a similar bill. Also in Nebraska, a anti-riot bill, but these were introduced, guess when? January 7th. And they were introduced by people who are pro-Trump. So what's going on there? And this really gives the game away. pro-Trump right-wing legislators in red states are introducing anti-riot bills the day after a pro-Trump riot in Washington, which they helped cheer on in order to prevent, punish, and suppress the next wave of Black Lives Matter, anti-fascist, or even anti-war protests. And so it's really dangerous when I hear people on the left talk about the Capitol riot as if it were this gigantic, well-calculated fascist coup, or use the term insurrection or sedition, when many revolutionary leftists have actually aimed to topple the system as well. And we know that these kind of laws have always been aimed at them and the left. So 26 states have these anti-protest laws already on the books, and they're trying to exploit what took place on January 6th, which many of the authors of these laws have encouraged in order to punish the left.
You know, let me, you mentioned about Cori Bush, you know, being in St. Louis, and I want to maybe paint a picture for people who weren't around during the Ferguson, you know, rebellion. If you were in Ferguson, and I'm going to tell you what I saw a year after the initial Mike Brown unrest, a year later, if you were standing near a protest, they didn't care if you was a journalist, they didn't care if you was walking your dog out your house, if you was near one, you were swooped up. Now, I remember, you know, talking with Jeff Chang, you know, author who was out there, and he was in a shopping mall that was next to a freeway. And I was on the phone with him, and I was like, hey, man, you know, we're going to meet up. Where you at? He's like, hey, I'm watching this protest. You know, people are on the freeway. Next thing you know, the phone was hung up, and everybody in that parking lot, everybody near the freeway, they were all about 200-300 people just swooped up and put into jail. And, you know, I didn't talk to them till the next day, right? So, you know, a lot of people, of course, got their charges dropped eventually, but what it was the inconvenience, and also the noting that people were gone for 12 hours, 10 to 12 hours, and put into jail, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people were shocked about that and were up in arms. And at the time, I remember having conversations with folks who say, well, these were very similar to the type of anti-drug sweeps that would take place in cities like Chicago and LA, where police would just come in and arrest maybe 1,500 people in one swell swoop, talking about they were trying to combat gang violence. So I want to kind of put this into context and just see that these type of draconian laws used to stop people from moving from point A to point B have always been used, but now they seem to be a little bit more formalized, I guess, or maybe more legalized. Walk us through this, because this seems like there's been a history of this, but for a lot of people, they're acting like this is kind of brand new. Or is it brand new?
Well, certainly it's not brand new. And I mean, you probably know better than I do how, you know, the initial anti-drug laws and the whole Reefer Madness campaign entered American life as an attempt to really propel the mass incarceration of Black and Latino males, and to crack down on the jazz and cabaret scene. Basically, it was motivated by sheer racism. Then we saw during the in the backlash to the 1960s, the rise of figures in big cities like Frank Rizzo, who were law and order Democrats, who imposed harsh sentences for people simply gathering in groups of 12 or more. And Rizzo amped up those laws to crush the MOVE organization. It initially kind of led to the shootout at Powelton Village with Philadelphia police, and then the bombing of the MOVE compound. But all sorts of laws were passed in Philadelphia to prevent people from simply gathering because of Rizzo's battle with MOVE and other revolutionary or radical left organizations. And so there's this long history that really never ended. There's a continuum going back to these darker periods, and we are seeing a resurgence of harsh repression that's being carried out in the open with police raids, militarized police raids, with the same militarized police force that was developed in order to conduct this drug war in the 80s and 90s, showing up at the homes of activists. I would also point to Aurora, Colorado, where several leaders from the, or activists from the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who were leading this struggle to hold the Aurora, Colorado police accountable for their murder of Elijah McClain, a young black man who was choked to death by cops, had a heart attack, and the police were overheard at a bar bragging about choking him to death and even making gestures mocking his death. These activists led a struggle around the police station, basically a peaceful sit-in, a series of protests demanding accountability. And it, last September, police showed up at their homes with militarized vehicles. Some were followed into traffic and surrounded by police cars. And these five activists, I believe, face something like 17 years in jail each.
Really? So what's the charge?
The charge is kidnapping. They are charged with felony charges, including kidnapping, because they surrounded a police station when police were inside. And for 3 or 4 hours, the police were unable to leave because they were outnumbered. But no one violently threatened the police. No one touched a police officer. And so the most serious charge is kidnapping, believe it or not. Joel Northam, Lillian House, and Eliza Lucero face, I believe, over 10 years in jail each. And, you know, it's important to support these activists. Liberationnews.org is a place to find information about them and to be really aware of the fact that people are facing hard jail time for leading protests, while many of the people who stormed the Capitol are out on bail right now.
Which leads to the next question. Here was an attempt to disrupt the process. What was done at the Capitol, in my opinion, far outweighed any sort of quote-unquote damage that may have been done elsewhere, because you had people that were killed, you had police that were beaten, and you had folks who planned and were ready to do damage to these lawmakers. What do you think ultimately will now happen with them? Do you see an argument being made, let's put water under the bridge and let's heal this country and let bygones be bygone type of rhetoric? And will that be extended to the protesters around the George Floyd thing? Or do you see this administration putting down the gun and even following the footsteps of their red counterparts and saying, you know, we might as well double down and make sure that these laws are in place for quote unquote everybody and just kind of really use this as an excuse to outlaw protests?
Yeah, that's the important question to ask right now. And I think a lot of people misinterpreted Joe Biden's inaugural address when he spouted this mantra of unity. He constantly used the term unity. And I think that was misinterpreted as a call for unity with the forces that stormed the Capitol, when what Biden is actually saying or calling for is a unity among elites to kind of salvage and consolidate the neoliberal political center and to guard it through coercion and even force against all threats from the left and the right. I guess in this case, particularly the right. Large sector of the Republican Party, its corporate wing, the wing of Mitch McConnell, is deeply threatened by the forces that showed up at the Capitol on January 6th. And we should also keep in mind that exhibitions of hooliganism and extremism, like we saw at the Capitol on January 6th, are a boon for the FBI and the security services, which are constantly seeking to justify their budget. I spoke to one of the organizers or a grassroots organizer of what took place at the Capitol from Utah, who helps lead a Utah militia group called Utah Citizens Alarm. And he told me that they are in disarray as a result of what took place and this the looming security crackdown, and that activists, right-wing activists, are turning each other in. Many of them are voluntarily leaving Facebook and other social media platforms. And of course, they've lost Parler, their alternative social media platform, because Amazon's web service kicked it off. So they are in a state of disarray. The FBI is focused on them for the first time in a long time. And I don't think that Biden is going to be positively inclined, or the wing of the Republican Party that he's going to primarily negotiate with is going to be positively inclined to the Trump wing of the Republican Party, which represents an existential threat to their political future. They may even seek to prosecute Trump, and the Senate is going to put Trump on trial for impeachment. So the question then remains, where does this leave the part of the left that hasn't already been co-opted by the Democratic Party, and which does seek a radical system change in the U.S.? And I do think that that is a question I'll just leave open, but I think all of this has implications for the left as well.
No, definitely. And I think you kind of painted a very good picture, and it's very nuanced. The picture that you paint shows that there isn't much difference between, and I'll use the word establishment Democrats and establishment Republicans. And if I'm hearing you correctly, that seems to be the nexus, is the word you use, that is sitting down and saying, hey, we got these Black Lives Matter and these Antifa folks over here. They're going, we got these militia guys and these, these QAnon folks over here. Why don't we just kind of make an agreement to smash on them both, and then we'll just, we'll hash out our own differences, in a more civil and more complimentary way. Is this how the picture is kind of shaping up?
Well, it ultimately will shape up that way, as we saw at the end of the Obama era, the failure of Obama to deliver material change, particularly for Black America, led to the rise of Black Lives Matter, and before that, Ferguson. Cornel West said this is a rejection of the Obama era, and we could see that towards the end of a first Biden term, or who knows who if he'll make it to a second term. But right now, I think the Biden-Harris administration is counting on their sheer presence and the absence of Trump quelling or mollifying what comprised Black Lives Matter, and that element of the left will simply be co-opted by their sheer presence. And it's going to be a while before there's a real conflict. And I think that it's important for people, whether you are organizing against, you're an anti-racism organizer, you're an anti-war organizer, or you're organizing for the freedom of Julian Assange, which I think is the most important press freedom issue of our time, the most important speech issue of our time, and one of the most important anti-war issues of our time, is that this is the administration that you can pressure, that is supposed to be receptive to you, and which ultimately won't be and needs to be exposed for that. And so I think it's important to not give them a honeymoon.
No, real talks, which leads me to my next question, Max Blumenthal. People talk about 100 days, and I've been asking people who have come on, what should we on the left, what should we, people who listen to this show, what should we, people who you talk to and you build with, and even yourself, if we're talking about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will have a 100-day agenda, and they're going to do all sorts of things and assigning executive orders and blah, blah, blah. If we were to follow that path, what should we be doing over the next 100 days?
Well, I can only tell you what I'm going to be doing and what at the Gray Zone we are going to be doing, because we work in media. We use journalism as a form of political education and I would say freelance diplomacy to try to build bridges with movements and nations that the U.S. seeks to simply destroy in imperialist fashion. And what we're going to do is to continue exposing these imperial plots and deceptions that are used to stimulate public support for them. The same thing we did during the Trump era, and which we did during the Obama era, we're going to continue during the Biden era. And the Biden foreign policy team is not encouraging, although there are a few exceptions, it's not encouraging. And one deeply troubling element is the desire of the Biden foreign policy team for add-ons of the Iran nuclear deal. It seems like they're going to make it impossible for Iran to return to a nuclear deal and continue this brinksmanship with Iran, which could provoke a regional war. So I don't think there's a chance to really breathe a sigh of relief, particularly when it comes to U.S. empire and the personnel that we see in the Biden administration mm-hmm. are not encouraging.
So that needs to be opposed. And I guess, you know, we're going to be looking at them smashing down on Venezuela, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, we saw Tony Blinken, the incoming Secretary of State, during his confirmation hearings, say that he'll continue to recognize Juan Guaido. This is someone who is not even elected in the Venezuelan National Assembly. He no longer holds a seat. So the irony of this is that there was recently a riot in the capital that the Biden administration condemned from an administration incited by a president who refused to recognize election results. But the Biden administration is refusing to recognize Venezuela's election results, is attacking its democratic institutions, and is conducting international piracy. Juan Guaido has been given $8 billion in gold that belongs to the Venezuelan state, which was looted from the Bank of England, and he has refused appeals to spend it on COVID vaccines for the Venezuelan people. So this is the arsonist that Trump created and which Biden and his administration are pumping formaldehyde into and just keeping alive as this kind of regime change zombie. The Biden administration will continue these deadly sanctions on Syria, the Caesar sanctions, which are depriving Syrian civilians of medicine, basic food, causing a bread crisis. The U.S. military occupies northeastern Syria and is preventing the country from accessing its own oil wells, depriving it of revenue. So now it has to import fuel. And the goal is to collapse the state, which will lead to massive misery. And we see the same kind of sanctions in play in Iran. What we focus on and what we maintain at the Gray Zone is that U.S. sanctions are the worst human rights crime in the world. But the first 100 days of the Biden administration, all we're going to hear about is China's supposed human rights crimes. So it's time to be skeptical about their agenda and expose what's behind it.
Domestically speaking, what do you think we should do with respect to these laws? I know you mentioned, this is supposed to be the administration that could be pushed. Do we do that? And at the same time, do you feel that we should really start to explore new ways to protest to get around these laws? Or taking it to the streets, is that going to be the hill that we die on? And does taking it to the streets really make a difference at this point?
Well, I got to be careful because I'm not a protest leader. Mm-hmm. You really have to pay your dues to speak to people and to tell them what needs to be done. And while I've been in protest movements since I can remember, I don't know if I paid those dues. What I would say is the ACLU and more established organizations are actively fighting these new protest laws. There is also a bill that was just introduced in Congress, surprisingly and very admirably, by Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, which was signed. It got signatures from the members of the Squad, the young progressive Democrats, the ACLU and Council on American Islamic Relations are backing it, but it needs more support. And this bill calls for no new security laws as a result of the Capitol riot, no new Patriot Act. And it's important that someone like Rashida Tlaib issued this bill because she is a Palestinian, she is an Arab, she is Muslim, and that's who the Patriot Act targeted. So it could be triggered by a riot by people who hate Muslims and Arabs and who are tend to be racist, but the law will ultimately affect the most vulnerable people. And so I think it's important to consider the new efforts to prevent this and support it, and to consider the obviously language isn't the most important thing, but to consider the language that we use when we when we talk about this Ku Klux Klan riot.
Right. Can we reach across the aisle and talk to the Ku Klux Klans? Are they talkable? You know,
I mean, I don't advocate like a red brown alliance, but there are definitely libertarians in Congress. Justin Amash in the Senate, Thomas Massey in the House, sometimes Rand Paul, who have been really helpful when it comes to opposing war, when it comes to hikes in the Pentagon budget, and they certainly oppose putting new Patriot Act style security crackdowns on the book. So when you're in Congress, it's all about building coalitions and transcending all of the culture war issues in order to get things done. And this is really about protecting whatever's left of this ramshackle, hollow democracy that we have.
Last question. And if you can put on your media hat, your journalism hat, you had started off by mentioning the reporters on CNN fawning over Biden Harris and shedding tears and acting shocked, you know, around the Trump scenario.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like, you know, from a journalistic perspective, these were the people that resurrected him. These were the people that reported his every move. These are the folks that fanned the flames and didn't really adequately challenge. And even as you're speaking, some of the information that you're sharing, you never heard them talk about any of this stuff. You know, the protesters who are facing 17 years in Aurora and the new bills, et cetera, et cetera. How do we start to deal with this corporate media apparatus, which definitely seems to be a integral part of some of the political and social upheaval and challenges that we all face because of how they frame things?
Well, the corporate media is an enemy of the people. It just is. The media isn't the enemy of the people, but we have to acknowledge that corporate media exists to generate consent and support for Wall Street and the war state. It's not just some slogan. It was proven in the Trump era when CNN and MSNBC, rather than opposing some of the most heinous things Trump did, like the $1 trillion tax cut or the militarization of the border, spent 4 years focusing on Russiagate in order to stimulate a new Cold War with Russia and hired every spook and Cold War kook that was available, including the former CIA director, the former director of national intelligence, the former chief of staff to the CIA, the former head of the NSA. These were all hired as contributors. And I just watched as so-called progressives had their brains hacked by this kind of coverage. And I even heard it kind of echoed in independent media, including on some Pacifica airwaves. And so I think it's important to recognize the agenda of corporate media as antithetical to anything progressive in this country, and also to recognize the role that stations like CNN played in creating Trump. It was Jeff Zucker, who was the producer of Trump's Apprentice, which gave Trump national appeal and became his vehicle for launching his first presidential campaign. And Jeff Zucker became executive director of CNN and made a concerted decision to promote Trump during the 2016 campaign, providing him with commercial free hour, 2 hour plus press conferences broadcast to the nation where he could freely call Mexicans rapists. And Les Moonves, former CBS executive, said that while we all hated Trump, he was really good for business. I remember CNN and the networks, the corporate media networks, all had people whose job, their beat, was to cover Donald Trump's Twitter account. Then at the 11th hour, at the end of the Trump era, they all celebrated and cried tears of joy when Trump's Twitter account was eliminated. Without Trump's Twitter account, they would have had no jobs. Without without Donald Trump's ludicrous behavior, that lady who made a comedy career out of lip syncing him would have had no job. Without Donald Trump, the whole national security apparatus that got big media jobs, they would have been working in low-level think tanks. So they created Trump. They are part of a system that created Trump, and they're still here, and they're celebrating Biden. CNN today removed its COVID tracker of COVID deaths because they don't want to associate Joe Biden with a COVID failure. And we have to question that and understand that their reverence for Biden and effort to mobilize popular support for his administration, which he has yet to earn, is part of the same political failure and catastrophe that we witnessed during the Trump era.
Wow. Those are sobering words, but very accurate and on point. And I'm glad that you broke that down. We're going to, you know, I say over the next 100 days and beyond, we're going to have that proverbial third eye open and take nothing for granted.
Well, you're the third eye. I mean, what we're doing here as independent journalists, and you in particular, educating people locally, that's the antidote to the corporate media. And so I hope you get all the support that you need, and we really need Pacifica and KPFA.
No doubt. And we need the Gray Zone. So how do people get a hold of the Gray Zone?
It's just the Gray Zone, thegrayzone.com, and it's G-R-A-Y, and it's not a hair club for men.
There you go. And you don't even have gray hair. Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. You gave us a wealth of knowledge, and it's very greatly appreciated, especially on the day after the inauguration. You gave us marching orders and sobered everybody up, put down the wine glasses, take off your dancing shoes, and let's get to work.
Don't go back to brunch.
No more brunch for a minute. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from the hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard stop. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard stop.
What does it mean to be sheltered in place if the place you sheltered in don't feel safe? And how do we become so qualified to judge and chastise and lose the ability to empathize with those who don't feel safe inside for whatever reason? You know, you sometimes ain't got the luxury of feeling safe at home when you ain't got a safe space to call your own. No privacy, no courtesy, no bed, nor peace of mind. You're grateful for a roof over your head, but that's not where everybody spends their time. So by this time, you're already mastered trying to stay out the way. And you already overheard chatter about not overextending your stay. And trying to find resources hard without a computer or Wi-Fi. Plus, employment opportunities are scarce and local businesses are boarded up. So you're being honest with yourself, asking like, why try? And it's not that everybody who's outside right now is even trying to be selfish. You know, some don't even want to be outside. They're just trying to avoid the insult of being displaced inside. You see, there's a lot of uncomfortable going on. And despite what you see on your timeline, not everybody's dancing to the same song. You know, some are dancing to the tune of loneliness and some ain't dancing at all. Some have their phones glued to their face and some ain't got no phones at all. No homes at all, no clocks on the wall, no time at all, no TikTok, no selfies, no hashtags, no memes. No statuses with complaints about how much food they overate. You know, some are still trying to find a meal and some are still trying to find their meal. I saw a broken car glass on my run around the block today. I must got a lot running through my mind today. Probably an indicator that I need to be still and pray, but the fact is we are all in this together, and the ones who judge and lead without love must not know no better. The world's lungs are under attack, and we're wasting precious breath on judgment, conspiracy theories about the government. Remember, we don't all have the same privilege when it comes on to access to information, and we're not all watching the same station. And after 10 years as an administrator in special education, I can tell you we all learn different. Matter of fact, it's time for a deep breath. It's time for a reset. Creatives, be gentle with yourselves. It's okay to take a break. Your value as a person is not defined by the art you create. Some of us are called to be light, and all of us are called to be salt. Preserve your well-being. Let love and kindness be your currency. Let Christ's compassion lead the way. And despite what economists say, empathy is the new wave, and it's the same as the old one too. It's all cyclical. And if you believe that money makes the world go round, then yeah, this standstill can be scary. But there are those of us who learn to speak without talking and move without walking. This is a journey to the inside. No more sweeping it under the rug. That rug is filled. And yes, the pain is present, but the love is real. So, today I'm gonna be patient with myself. The goal is to be present, not perfect. And parents, you don't have to be perfect. This ain't no normal homeschooling. Your children can feel the world's stress. And under such circumstances, no one learns their best. And you are doing your best. And might I add, a damn good job? And so are our essential workers too. And right now, I'm gonna say a special prayer for our social workers and educators too. And all the folks doing food accessibility work, I see you. Three black chefs in Meadowview, I see you. And I thank you from the abundance of my heart. And for our families with loved ones behind bars, I know this season is hard. So I don't want to offer any platitudes or throw any out of context scripture your way. And for those of us who've lost loved ones to the virus, we lament and pray. We are experiencing a collective grief to a scale none of us have ever seen before. Be gentle with yourselves. Do not harden your hearts. It may be Christ knocking at the door.
COVID-19, weapon of mass incompetence. As of this writing, 10,000 people have died from the impacts of the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19. 10,000. And unless I miss my guess, it ain't over yet. That's because the coronavirus is not slowing down. If anything, it's picking up speed. Almost everything we've heard about the virus from the media during the first week is false or misleading. I'm not talking about the big idiots crowing about it's a hoax. It's not. Originally, it was a virus attacking old people. We now know better. Young people, including children and even infants, have succumbed to this disease. There was an old woman in Italy who contracted the virus. She was sick and then recovered. She was 102 years old. Viruses are living things, and like all living things, they surprise us. The U.S. government had months to prepare for the coming of the coronavirus. They treated it lightly. And nearly 1,000 deaths a day proved that it is indeed deadly serious. We will see worse. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything.
area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out Need and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel crate beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I lay with a breeze. Made a spoon shade on your name in the street. You go. Hey, ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
In the morning, sounding like he was mourning, barely dawning. His voice already had the weight of the world all on it. The worry and stress, not just bills and the rent, but the global unrest when we never know what's coming next. I wrote these 16s under quarantine from a pandemic, and the whole planet's panicking, imagining where we headed. Like tomorrow, something dreaded to just expect the unexpected. Fear of the future diluting our faith, but wait, we can't let it. Cause we fathers now. It falls on our shoulders to mold our children with hope and show them the beauty all around. We'll walk to the park and just stare at the stars and wonder. I'll run through the mud and the rain and then hide from the thunder. Build castles in the sand, just let them laugh and play. And tuck them in and tell them stories that'll never wash away. And Bobby, keep a smile, but when it's time to cry, let them fall with pride. That's the love you feel for that little guy. Gives them wings to fly. Above all the obstacles, full of love, they can stop and pull off to accomplish the impossible. Let's watch them fly. Above all the worldly madness, it's hard to imagine something as simple as laughter will give them wings to fly. Above all the worry and stress that's bubbling in your chest, just keep doing your best, brother, and stay fly. The days are long, the years come by surprise. Deep breaths through it all, cause time loves to just fly by. Don't waste a second of it. I know it's heavy in the moment, but we'll rise above it. Turn off the news and social media, just unplug it. Cause all it's gonna do is make you wanna say it. But focus where the love is. Don't waste a second of it. I know it's heavy in the moment, but we'll rise above it. Turn off the news and social media, just unplug it. Cause what we need to do is simply focus where the love is. The love is. The love is in the eyes of your child, the way they shine like only freedom does when they're young and running wild. The love is in the sound that they laugh, the sun like the song from the heavens. You gonna wish you could remember every second. The love, you find it in the person who you blessed to be with, the one you share your life with and all of your secrets. The love is in your family, both blood and chosen. Relationships over distances with bonds unbroken. Just focus on the beauty in life, though it's interwoven with strife. And every day feels like a roll of the dice, with leeches bleeding the planet like they not knowing the price. But everything can change for the better when the moment's precise. So hold tight, remember life rotates in phases, and sometimes we find God in some of the least expected places. And it's darkest before sun up, go on and pick your son up, tell him you love him and why you're teaching him how to fly. Above all the obstacles, full of love, they can stop and pull off to accomplish the impossible. Let's watch him fly. Above all the worldly madness, it's hard to imagine something as simple as laughter will give them wings to fly. Above all the worry and stress that's bubbling in your chest, just keep doing your best, brother, and stay fly. The days are long, the years come by surprise. Deep breaths through it all, cause time loves to just fly by. Don't waste a second of it. I know it's heavy in the moment, but we'll rise above it. Turn off the news and social media, just unplug it. Cause all it's gonna do is make you wanna say it. But focus where the love is. Don't waste a second of it. I know it's heavy in the moment, but we'll rise above it. Turn off the news and social media, just unplug it. Cause what we need to do is simply focus where the love is. The love is.
Ha, hey, ho, 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 Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo, it's
a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Tune in on fourth Thursdays at 3 a.m. for The Metal Margin with me, your host, The Metal Maestra, featuring all women and people of color in metal, including this band from Navajo Nation, female-fronted Existence AD.